wishing all Radio Aryan listeners
a happy Christmas
and a diversity-free New Year.
Happy Christmas from Radio Aryan. Have a pro-white Christmas and a diversity-free New Year. And remember, a kebab is not just for Christmas. Listen to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is the 23rd of December 2016 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. Once again today, I am joined by the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Mr. Dennis Wise, and also Messerschmitt with another presentation for us from Schmitt's Axis War Heroes. Dennis, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thanks. I'm getting into the Christmas spirit. That's a nice Christmas opening.
Yeah, we can thank Noel for that behind the White Genocide Project. He makes up all those little intros and outros for us. He's a really talented young man making all that music for us, and he made a special three or four, I think he made for us of these Christmas ones. So yeah, it's good to use them. It definitely gets us in the Christmas spirit.
Schmitt, how are you? Christmas.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. Well, we haven't got long to go now, have we? We've just got Christmas Eve tomorrow, and then that's it. And then next weekend, we've got New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, but hopefully it isn't going to interrupt the Radio Aryan schedule too much. I think we're going to have a Truth Without Radio next week. Is that right, Dennis?
And that's why not.
Excellent. I'm up for that. Schmitt, how are you doing today?
Well, that's quite the same with me. I'm getting into the spirit of Christmas, and I'm in quite a good mood. I listened to the Hangout that Millennial Woes did with Nathan D'Amigo, and there were some really good news from the US, because it seems like their organization, Identity Europa, is getting a lot of people who want to join and want to help out. So, yeah, that's good news for me.
Yeah, you know, we need some positive news at the moment with all these terrible things that are going on around us, all these terrorist acts. But of course, the more terrorist acts there are, the more people come towards nationalism. And then, of course, the government starts getting worried about it and they start calling us terrorists and trying to ban us. But again, the more they do that, the more people will just come to our side. And we know that we'll win in the end, because the truth is on our side. It's not on their side. We got some more hidden truth tonight, I believe, with your presentation, which is on this famous U-boat Captain Schmitt. I'm really looking forward to hearing this, and we're going to have a bit of a discussion about part of it when you finish, to do with the Weimar period. I think Dennis knows a fair bit about that, so we're going to pick his brains about that after. But do you want to tell us who it is that you're going to be doing this presentation on, and start the presentation then, please, Schmitt?
Yes, gladly. So today I'm going to talk about Günther Prien. It may start out somewhat depressing, and that is because Prien was growing up in depressing times. I had some difficulties reading his memoirs because the font used is the calligraphic Fraktur, which was the standard at the time. Yet I enjoyed reading it a lot. It really gave me some insight into where Prien was coming from, not just geographically, of course, but also what he experienced as a young man. So, Günther Prien, he was born on the 16th of January 1908 in Osterfeld, which was back then in the province of Saxony, and today in occupied Germany, in the federal state of Saxony-Anhalt. His father was a judge, and he had two younger siblings, Liselotte and Hans Joachim. To give you a first impression of what life was like in the Weimar Republic, I will quote Prien from his memoirs. quote, "It was in Leipzig in the grievous summer of 1923. Inflation had plundered us all. Our parents had become poor. The streets we walked looked grey, filthy and squalid." End quote. Prien then goes on to describe how he and his friend were debating how to best break the news to their parents that they intended to become sailors. For reasons unknown to me, Prien's father did not live with them in Leipzig, so in Prien's case, it was his mother he had to convince. From early age on, Günther had wanted to become a sailor. Over his bed, he had a picture of Vasco da Gama hanging, the famous Portuguese explorer who was the first to find a naval route to India and thus gave Portugal a monopoly for the trade with India for a few decades. And that one was the favorite of all his seagoing heroes of the past, as Prien himself puts it. Again and again, he read these stories about da Gama's life and how he came back from India a hero, honored by the king and celebrated by his people. A life like that is what he dreamed about in his childhood, and in some ways that dream became true for his own life, as we shall see. So he went home and, quoting again, "The table had already been set. Liselotte and Hans Joachim were sitting in their high children chairs, pale and intimidated. On the vertigo were three letters in blue envelopes, bills. My mother entered and brought in the food. We had barley soup. We ate in silence. Is it a lot? I asked and tilted my head towards the blue envelopes. The worst is the dentist, she sighed and added. People who have nothing to bite don't really need teeth, do they? I looked at her. In her kind round face, there was a tormented, bitter trait. No, I couldn't tell her. At least not today." End quote. Eventually, he gathered enough courage and did tell her. She was not exactly pleased, but she knew that it had been his dream for so long, and so she gave her approval. She had no money with which she could have paid for his education to join the German merchant navy, but Günther had earned, as a tourist guide, 91 Swedish kronor, or crowns, which were just enough to pay for the three-month class at the German school for seamanship at Finkenwerder in Hamburg. Please keep in mind that the German mark was as good as worthless in these times, so having foreign currency was probably the only way to keep your money's worth, aside from having precious metals or similar valuables or commodities.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same today, isn't it? It was Sweden has a very high exchange rate, so it was obviously quite high back then. One of the things that just struck me then, Schmidt, as you were talking, was Leipzig. Wasn't that the same place that Hitler was brought up in? Am I wrong there, or am I right there? Dennis, can you answer that one? Where am I remembering Leipzig from?
If I may... maybe Dennis has some sound problems. I don't know where you make this connection with Leipzig, but Hitler spent a lot of his time, his early youth in Vienna, as far as I know, and he grew up in Braunau in Austria.
I wonder where I'm thinking of Leipzig from. Yeah, but Braunau, I mean, wasn't it, that Hitler was brought up in? But
yes.
I was just thinking Leipzig. I'm sure I remember it from somewhere. And barley soup. I mean, that shows you how poor they were, doesn't it? You know, they're not having vegetable soup, but barley soup. You know, they're using cereals to make soup from. I mean, that shows you that they're not very well off if they're having to use something like that in order to make the soup. I mean, I wouldn't want to have barley soup, would you?
No, not really. Certainly wouldn't be what I would pick.
Better,
but
better wrap,
even considering that... his father was a judge, so I would say that his family wasn't the worst off. I think a lot of Germans were even much worse off than that.
Dennis, where am I thinking of Leipzig from?
Do you not have a clue? I really haven't.
But it wouldn't have been that that swastika that was on the church. Was that at Leipzig? Or was he educated at Leipzig at some point?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Well, perhaps it will come to me at some point, maybe not by the end of the podcast, but hopefully it will. I'm sure I remember it from somewhere. I'll try and have a think. Anyway, Schmidt, if you've suitably refreshed yourself, if you'd like to continue.
Yes. After those 3 months, Prien and his friend passed the exams. However, because of the dire economic situation, nobody wanted to hire them. The director of the school, through his connections, was able to find a ship, the full-rigged ship Hamburg, that would take them, but they would not get any money and instead would have to pay 30 marks, the reasoning being that they would be more of a hindrance to the ship than be helpful as they were still learning, which doesn't really make sense, but I guess times were really that bad. Neither Günther Prien nor his friend would have been able to pay that, and so the director talked to the responsibles again and was able to get that fee off the table. Prien's friend, however, still asked what pay they were going to get. In the end, they at least were promised that it would start at zero mark and then slowly rise, whatever that would mean in the end. The Hamburg, as I mentioned before, was a full-rigged ship, a sailing ship, and Prien was about to learn sailing and seamanship in the true sense of these words, and the hard way. He started at the very bottom of the ship's hierarchy, and his first job was to clean the toilets. The food was terrible. They would eat bread, out of which bugs would crawl if you hit the hard bread on the table. The rest of the food wasn't that much better, except on Sundays sometimes, when it was somewhat decent. They also had a terrible cook, but some more of that later. At times he would have to go aloft in the worst of weathers and adjust the sails with his fellow sailors. The main mast was 55 meters high, and there were 28 different sails to take care of. His hands would nearly freeze in the cold weather, and yet the work was so hard that his shirt would cling to his back from the sweat. Yet he also experienced moments which made it all worth to him. The following quote is right after he describes the hard work and the shirt clinging to his back. Quote, "But sometimes I did look around to watch the moonlight play on the white canvas. Even more beautiful, though, when I was standing on the deck again. There, three silvery towers were rising in front of me, their tops disappearing in the night sky. The wind was singing in them, and from below, the deep and regular rushing of the bow wave. We were sailing. It was as if an invisible power had taken hold of the ship and was dragging it along, softly but irresistibly. No engine noise, only this deep, regular rushing." End quote. They were sailing in the Bay of Biscay and then towards the Azores. Their destination was the Americas, and more specifically Pensacola. Some of the crew were plotting to leave the ship there because they were so fed up with the hard work, the bad food, and general conditions. Prien was almost convinced by some of them, as they painted a picture of how great life in the United States would be for them, and he was friends with one of the would-be defectors. But an older, wiser sailor by the name of Vitashek talked some sense back into Prien. He would be neglecting his duty, and worst of all, he could never again be a sailor. Nobody would hire a sailor who was known to have defected from a ship, he said. "Look, I know the food we were given was terrible. The captain was behaving like a tyrant, but an honest sailor just doesn't do that." And that made an impression on Prien. He told the others that he would not join them, but he also did not report any of this to the captain. One morning, after they were anchored at Pensacola, 9 of the crew were missing, including the cook, or smutje, as the cook is called in German naval jargon. The captain and the boatswain were furious, but only one of the defectors was reapprehended, as he was stupid enough to try to go back on board to fetch some things he had left behind. As they lifted the anchors to sail back home, they sang a shanty, a sailor song, which is sung only once each voyage, this particular shanty, precisely when they started their voyage back home. You may be surprised to hear that it's sung in English, but by the way, the dialects of northern Germany are even closer to English than other German dialects, both languages having Germanic at their root, with English merely having some of the non-Germanic influences mixed in. The shanty goes as follows. Rolling home, rolling home, rolling home across the sea, rolling home to my old Hamburg, rolling home my land to thee.
Did they actually sing that in English, or did they sing that in German and you translated it to English? Did you mean that they actually used to sing this song in English and others in English, Schmidt?
Yes, they did. I was actually quite surprised, but I thought it was because Northern Germany is somewhat more maybe akin to England, has an affinity towards England. Maybe it's that. And I think the sailors had a lot in common. They would meet each other, at least in times of peace, and exchange songs. I'm guessing that is why that is.
That really does surprise me. The German language is quite different to English. I know the Anglo-Saxon language back then, it was probably similar, but then the English language changed when the Normans came over. They banned the Anglo-Saxon language. Nice to think of them singing in English songs in their white brother's language. I think it's really good of him to refuse to give up like the others did. You know, that shows that he had character. And I believe that when you first go on a vessel, when you've never been at sea before, that they will deliberately treat you as hard as possible, you know, to sort of break you in, as it were, because then they know that you'll put up with whatever. If you get rough weather, then you're prepared for it. You've already, seen life as hard as it can get. They want people that they can really rely on when you're at sea. You don't want someone that's going to freak out at sea because there's nowhere for them to go. They can't leave the boat once the boat has left the shore. It's not like you're on land and you can leave work and you can just walk out and throw your hands up in the air. You've got to stay there, and you've also got to have a stable temperament so that other people aren't put at risk. So I would suggest that the skipper of the vessel was deliberately being harsh with them in order to test them out, if that was his first voyage. That's from what I know of voyaging and going to sea anyway. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that before Schmidt continues?
Well, interesting enough, I was in the Bay of Biscay once on a cruise, and everybody, including myself on board, was seasick. One of the most memorable times of my life. No, one of the biggest disappointments is that Messerschmitt didn't sing that song. I was working.
I don't think I have the voice for that, to be honest.
Did it have music with it? Was it possible to sing it? Or does it just have the line there?
No, I don't know the tune, but actually I think the tune is mentioned. I think he writes something this text goes to the tune of this and the, or that song, but I am not familiar with it. So even if I would have wanted to, I couldn't have.
Fair enough.
Do you sing at all, Schmidt? You've got a very bassy voice. So I imagine you'd probably be quite good in a choir with the bass.
Only under the shower to myself, maybe. No, I've never sang in any choir or any, no, I don't.
Okay, well, we won't make you do it now then.
I'm glad for that.
Okay.
And they did give him a hard time at first. When he came on board, he addressed one of the other sailors with du. And you may be, you may know that in German, there's the distinction between you and sie. You address your friends, your colleagues with du usually. And people you're not that familiar with or superiors, you address with the more polite sea. And that other sailor started hitting him. And only because a more senior sailor saw this and sort of protected Preen, did he not get beaten up. And actually, Preen said later to that sailor, I wouldn't have let him keep beating me. I would have fought back, and I would have probably beat him. But then the older sailor said, you would have been the weaker in any case, because if you had managed to beat up that sailor, we all, the rest of the sailors, would have had to be due up because discipline demands that. So, yeah, these were rough times.
Yeah, it would have been insubordination if he'd, yes, if he'd done that. And he was too informal. And I think on the boats as well, discipline is, it is physical discipline, or it always was. That probably isn't so much now. You know, they used to have a cat of nine tails. And again, because there's too much risk of, if you're at sea, if somebody does something stupid, that, you know, everyone else is then put at risk by them. So you'd have to use physical discipline in order to keep order. It's a very different to being on the land, a different situation altogether, I think. I think if you're on the boats at sea, you're allowed to keep guns on there, I believe, and there's different laws for piracy as well, for if somebody gets on the boat that isn't part of the crew. There's all different laws that they have at sea to that they actually have on the land, and there's like a sort of brotherhood of people that do go to sea, these sailors, fishermen, yachtsmen, and you know, more so the sailors and the fishermen, I would have thought. Was this merchant vessel that he was on, or was this a naval vessel that he was training on?
That was a merchant vessel. They were carrying cargo.
Yeah, merchant navy. They still would have had strict discipline on there. More discipline than they would have had at land, I would have thought. But
yes, I did get a sense of that when reading his memoirs.
I'm sort of dragging the conversation off its theme a bit here. Would you like to continue, Schmidt?
Yes. The voyage home was not uneventful at all. On the contrary, they had to deal with a fire on board, which almost turned disastrous as stored petrol was in danger of igniting. But this was resolved, fortunately. Preen and a friend were now acting as cooks because the cook had defected, as I said earlier. Their food was so much better that the crew was used to So that they soon endeared themselves to everybody, except for that one time when. But I should really cut this short. I tremendously enjoyed reading about his career as a merchant sailor, but I shouldn't go too far off topic here. So when they were almost back home, they got into a very severe storm and had to seek shelter in Dublin. The Hamburg was quite damaged in the events, in fact, so much so that it was later declared a total wreck. Preen and his fellow sailors did enjoy their time in Dublin, though, as the Irish were especially friendly to the Germans. Another ship was sent to fetch them and bring them back to Germany. This was only the first of many merchant marine or navy voyages, and Preen slowly worked his way up, serving as a fourth officer on a steamer, for example, and then later even managed to become a licensed captain. These were still the days of the Weimar Republic, though, and he could not find any work as a captain. He tried to find any kind of work, but was unsuccessful. He didn't seek unemployment money until all his savings were spent, and he couldn't bear the thought anymore of friends or his mother assisting him. He reluctantly went to the assistance board. I will quote what he experienced there. In the grey and dirty waiting room, some people were sitting. They looked exhausted, completely wrecked, as if destitute had eaten them from the inside and had left nothing but an outer shell. End quote. And later, when he was in the queue to collect the money, he observed the dehumanizing effect the situation had on the people. The stamping of documents was the metronome. Quote, it moved rhythmically, this procession of misery, always intact according to the drumbeat of destitute. The view of all these jaded, hopeless faces, the rancid smell of poverty, the constant rum-bum, and he means the sound of the stamp, was crushing. End quote. He felt anger rising in himself, anger at those in power who didn't seem to care one bit about the plight of the working man. Or again, in his own words, quote, how could they sleep at night as long as there were people strong and healthy, willing to work, greedy for work, and now rotting like foul straw? Those few pennies that they threw at you were only staving off actual starvation. They gave them grudgingly because they feared our desperation. Oh, indeed, they were able to sleep, these gentlemen. They were able to sleep only too well on the soft cushion of their motto, live and let live. But reality had removed the glitter from their hollow phrases. We down here saw life as it was, and we also saw how they were. Live and let die, that was in truth their motto. End quote. A furious anger against this soft, mendacious indifference took hold of me. Actually, the quote wasn't over yet. It was in these days that I became a member of the National Socialist Movement. End quote. And by the way, the German Wikipedia article on Günter Prien says he joined the NSDAP in 1931, but this is clearly wrong. And the English one, on the other hand, is correct when it says 1932. Apparently, Prien joined the movement as party member number 1,128,487. He wanted to work, and since there was no paid work available, he volunteered for the Voluntary Reich Labor Service. Even there he was refused because they deemed him too old at 24 years of age. But then finally one application to go work camp was answered in a positive way. To give some more insight into his personality, I will quickly quote what happened when he arrived by train near where the work camp was. Quote, I was depressed. Each time before a sea voyage, I felt upbeat, but I wasn't looking forward to what was coming this time. Certainly, any kind of life was better than lazily sitting around. But I was a sailor with heart and soul after all, and a sailor on land feels betrayed, like a duck on dry soil. In the garden of a villa, he saw a girl sitting, blonde and entirely in white. I looked at her and felt bitter that more than a garden fence separated me from her. End quote. But he felt inspired, set down his baggage and went to buy roses. He entered the garden, went up to the girl, handed her the flowers and kissed her. The girl looked at him in astonishment, but she did not say anything. He gazed into her eyes for another moment and then turned to leave, not looking back. This event would later lead to his marriage, but in a somewhat unexpected way. And I will talk a bit more about this in the second part next week. During his time at the work camp, the depot master there committed suicide. They found a letter in which his girlfriend had written to him that she had been waiting for 4 years now and that he would never find paid work. By the time they could marry, she would be an old woman. And Prien's comments on that reads as follows. Yes, it was always the same. Destitute, misery, desperation, and the future like a merciless gray sky. You had to be tough to be able to bear it. End quote. As we know, times were about to change in Germany, but it came too late for that poor fellow. At the work camp, Prien quickly rose through the ranks of the hierarchy there and became deputy to the camp commander. When the camp commander was on leave and Prien was in charge, he learned that leadership is not always easy and hard decisions have to be made at times. A ham had been stolen in a nearby village and it seemed likely that one of his men did it. Or boys, rather. After some investigation, he found the thief. It was a thin and small boy from Dresden, a poor wretch who admitted to the theft immediately when confronted with the accusation. Tears were streaming down the boy's face, but he would not reply when asked why he had stolen the ham. It later turned out that his mother was very ill, and he had intended to sell the ham so he could send the money home to his mother. Even after learning this, Prien did not revise his decision to send the boy home. His reasoning was that discipline could not be kept if he were to make an exception for the boy. The reputation of the work service was also at stake if thievery was not punished, even though it was a very hard decision for him. For a last quote today, this is what Prien thought about the dilemma, and next week we will hear about his career in the German Navy, the military Navy. Quote, for the first time, I had perceived this antagonism in its full sharpness. Here, the lot of an individual. there the well-being of the community. I had decided for the community, and I knew I would act in the same way each time, no matter how hard it would be. End quote.
So when he was working there with that work detail, was that after the National Socialists had taken power? Was that with the Weimar Republic still? And was he being paid for that work detail, or was that he just had to work and went out and did voluntary work?
Well, to the first question, it was the Weimar Republic, and this voluntary Reich Labor Service was actually, the NSDAP was already in parliament, and they had pushed for this, they pushed so hard with that much pressure that the government actually gave in, and so the voluntary labor service was actually created before the National Socialists took power. And he did not get paid. He would get free quarters and get free food, but he did not get any pay from that.
That's what I was just thinking. He must have still had a roof over his head and food given to him for that. But at least he was contributing to the country. This is what they should be doing when you've got unemployment, is providing the things that people need and setting up projects that need doing. The roads need repairing, telephone line cables need laying so that everyone has the internet. And this is something they could be doing today in Britain. They could be providing, the work there to get everybody connected to the internet and providing food and lodging and clothing and a bit of money on the side to the people that are doing it. Instead of saying, well, we can't afford to do this, or we haven't got enough people to do this. They shouldn't be importing foreigners into the country when you've got unemployed British people. It's this is one of the good things about Donald Trump. One of the first things he said he was doing was a big engineering project, infrastructure project, which is going to provide jobs for people. Obviously, building the wall is going to provide jobs for people. And it gives you an idea of how poor they were as well in that period. If that young lad had to steal that ham, and if he was unable to find a job doing anything, and you're talking somebody with skills there as well, who's been in the merchant navy, I would also say that that was probably very character building for him as well, seeing the state that the people around him were in. And then when he was a naval officer, he would have been sort of upper class, but he'd also seen what it was like to be lower class. So I should imagine he was a very fair man to work under, as it were. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that before we move into the Weimar discussion?
Yeah, well, I had to smile when he said he couldn't find a job, because at the time, under the Weimar Republic, they only had 36 ships due to the, Versailles Treaty. So there would have been a queue for jobs on them ships, I'm sure.
Yeah, they really took everything off them, didn't they? I mean, that was the military side of it, wasn't it? Was that the military? Is that right?
Oh, yeah, it was. Ships? Yeah, sorry. It was. They weren't allowed a navy. Well, maybe. I'm not so sure about that, because they weren't allowed a navy. They just had 36 ships in actually active. So it could well have been. I wouldn't have just thought it was military.
Well, I would have thought if they wanted to take everything they could from Germany, didn't they? So yeah. There really wouldn't have been very much trade that Germany could do, sending ships abroad, selling stuff. The other victorious powers would have wanted their cut of it. They would have been wanting to take it from Germany and then sell it on to make money for themselves. They wouldn't have allowed Germany to trade. I think that was the whole point of the First World War, was that Germany was getting too big at trade and too good at trading. And Britain wanted to be on the top, and America wanted to be on the top, and they couldn't possibly allow Germany to get a footing. I think that was why Hitler was saying, well, we'll get land in Russia or stay in Europe, and we'll let you guys have all the colonies if you just let us have some land here in Europe for when our people increase in size. And they weren't allowed to have that either. Yeah, they really wanted to keep Germany down, didn't they?
Well, took all the colonies off them, didn't they? So they're never going to throw an helping hand, I don't think.
Well, thanks for that, Schmidt. I look forward to hearing some more of it next week. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Weimar period now. And you know, chime in if you got anything that you feel that you can add to it, Schmidt.
Sing in if you want.
Yeah.
Okay.
Please, yeah. Please do. Anyway, yeah, Dennis, you've done a fair bit of research into this period, haven't you?
Well, I did. Yeah, in the documentary, Adolf Hitler, great story. obviously, the Weimar. It was the first time that Germany had become democratic, which Hitler never really spoke favourably about. Democracies, as he said, great men don't come through democracies. And it lasted from 1919 to 1933. But the name, believe it or not, only became mainstream after 1933. It was known before then as the Deutsches Reich. But the National Socialists didn't want the word Reich associated with that period. Hitler first mentioned the name Weimar Republic in a speech in 1929. So that was the reason for the name. Like we said, they were only allowed 100,000 army, 10 armoured cars, would you believe? And like I say, a navy, 36 ships, no air force, of course. The capital of it was Berlin, which epitomised it. That became the sex capital of the world. Also known as the Babylon of the 1920s. And it was full of lesbian and homosexual activity. What was once considered immoral under this republic was no longer. Now, this freedom, this democratic freedom as such, anything went. There was no censorship in the cinemas or in the clubs. And typically, it was Sin City. In Berlin, again, it was a fighting ground for left-wing politics. I mean, we see what happened in Berlin this past week, with the Muslim tragedy. It's suffering under left-wing politics here. I mean, it's claimed that the city was a magnet for artists and film directors and writers, all left-wing, and in fact, every intellectual in the city was a leftist. They were a city filled with socialists, Bolsheviks, revolutionaries, and of course, the good old Jew. Munich, in fact, was a city for the stronghold for nationalists, which often, you know, they call them right-wing, but I call them centre-ground. Anybody what loves the country and prepared to uplift the country to me is centre-ground, whether people like it or not. But anyway, by 1922, the inflation had spiraled out of control and people would get up in the morning to get paid. Then they'd have to run with a suitcase full of money to shops before the prices went up again. I had to actually believe that, but I mean, running around with a suitcase full of money is just, I mean, you expect somebody rich, but this is actually the reverse. Anything up to $10 in that city would buy you anything. In the sex world, and it got to a stage where people in their own homes, in the middle class Berliners, did transform their homes into a house of pleasure for tourists, believe it or not, and they put a sex show on. The family would actually put a sex show on for a dollar. And one so-called house was turned into a club, aptly named All in the Family. And every possible taste was catered for, which the mind boggles. And it's a city where teenagers became prostitutes, fathers became the pimps, would you believe? Literally anything in the sexual world known to man was available. We're even talking paedophilia and animal sex. On any given night, there was 100,000 prostitutes in the city. And believe it or not, even pregnant prostitutes. And what they used to do was they'd line up in the sides of the pregnancy so that limos could pull up and choose or request the size of pregnant woman they required. It's just getting to be quite a sick place. Also, prostitutes with ugly scars, and there are even prostitutes who were mother and daughter twosomes were available. And out of this cesspit would emerge lesbians like Marlene Dietrich, and she were best known for giving the best oral sex, would you believe? Drugs, obviously, available, any type of drug. The most popular were morphine, cocaine and opium, which leads us to Papa Magnus Hirschfeld. I think we've mentioned this guy before. He was known as the Einstein of sex, and was given the award of inventing the scientific culture into sex in Berlin. Needless to say, he was Jewish, homosexual, and he was social democrat, who Hitler often accused of being a cover for communism, which of course Merkel is one today. And he even starred in the first ever homosexual movie in history in Germany, in the German film industry. The German film industry was even far more advanced than Hollywood. In fact, they used to come over from Hollywood to learn from the Germans. And this guy had a museum of sexual machinery for masturbation and trousers that could strip away for a pervert to flash with ease. So we get a picture of this degrading city, which is often, as you mentioned, Sven, known as a city of that time of great culture.
Well, that was it. When I looked at, I looked up the Weimar Republic in Wikipedia, and it talked about a golden age of culture, and how the speculators with all the money, where they had to spend all this money, they drove this great bursting forth of culture, and they would invest all their money in these things. It was wonderful, according to Wikipedia. Because all this money, all off the backs of the Germans, wasn't it? They bought up all the farms. Farmers were reduced to sell everything. They'd been owning the farmland in their family for generations. And this was one of the things the National Socialists did, wasn't it? They banned all of that. Said, no, you can't sell the farmland that's been in that family for generations, and you have to give it back. And these people, that's why they had all this money to spend. It was only the Jews that had that money to spend. It's only the internationalists. It wasn't the Germans. It was the Jews that had all the money to spend. So they were the ones that were paying for the prostitution and the poor German people. That's what they were reduced to, selling their bodies just in order to make enough to pay for the food to live for from one day to the next.
Tourist trade, yeah.
What I would have to say on that is that what Wikipedia is doing is, this is almost like Orwellian newspeak. They call it culture, but it was degeneracy. And what Dennis just told us is so depressing if you think about it. But I would take some hope from that, because as we know, it was turned around in only a few years. And I think even our situation now can be fixed and turned around.
It just requires the willpower to do it, doesn't it? The willpower to do it, and somebody to get into power that can do it with the levers of power. That's why we've got so much hope for Donald Trump, that he's going to turn the ship around. And as we know, I mean, it takes some time to actually do that. You know, you turn the wheel of the ship. If you've got a huge ship there, it's going to be, you know, half an hour before you see any movement, maybe even longer than that. You know, it takes a long time to steer a huge ship. And that's what this is. It's like the ship of state that's going in one direction, that we want to see it turned around. You're not going to turn it around really quick. It has to be turned around by small degrees, the same way that it got to where we are today, was like by small increments. It didn't suddenly go from in the 60s where 99% of people were married to 50% of people being divorced, and homosexual marriage being the same as marriage, and the pill, and people expected to have sex before marriage. It didn't all happen overnight. It happened gradually over the last 70 years. I mean, this Weimar period, I mean, this had built up as well. This didn't happen overnight. I think the Jews in the late 19th century, just before it got into the 20th century, they were making plays about divorce, weren't they? I remember in your Babylon supplement, you've got that, I forget his name, Benjamin something or other, the Jew that became a Catholic and then exposed Friedman, what went on. Yeah, Friedman. And he talks about it. This Hirschfeld that you were talking about, the sex scientist, he was the forerunner of Kinsey, wasn't he, in America in the 60s, the 50s and 60s.
Well, they moved out to America, didn't they, and brought this subculture out to America. So, you know, it should have been put down, really, but the Americans didn't, and so it spread.
Well, so it's the same thing, wasn't it, with the Frankfurt School and with all these sexual experimenters. Once they saw that National Socialism was on the rise, they all fled to America and set up shop there, and then corrupted American society.
To the point we are today, where that is wrecked.
Well, the problem with the American society is that it's ubiquitous. It's all around the world, isn't it? You know, this is a problem. I mean, in Germany, most people see it as an American intrusion on Germany, but it's not. It's a Jewish intrusion on Germany. You know, this is a fault I used to have. I used to blame America for what was in Hollywood and what their television was like, and I realised that they're all Jews. All those names that it's hard to pronounce, they're all Jews. All those people with that annoying accent, they're all Jews. But when you don't know that, you just think, it's Americans. It's these degenerate Americans that are encouraging all this with their films and the way that they speak. But it's not, you know. Americans are good people. And when you read into the history of it all and how it all happened, the Americans, I think, from the 1900s and the early 1900s and the late 1800s were fantastic people. You read some of the people that were writing around the time that they were doing away with slavery. I mean, real fine, upstanding Christian people that just wanted the best for their nation. And nothing like the sort of people that Hollywood portrays now as being Americans. I was really surprised at some of the books I read, these books from around that time. I do recommend them to people. You can find them on archive.org. Sorry, Schmidt, were you going to say something then?
Yes, unfortunately, a lot of these Jewish names actually sound German, and that's because they probably lived in Germany before they got to the U.S. For example, MGM, Metro, Goldwyn, Meyer. Meyer is a typical German family name. But they are Jews, Goldwyn and
Meyer. In fact, it's funny you mention that, because I've read something about Wagner not too long ago, and he, above anything, he hated Jews that actually declared themselves German and Christian, because he felt that they were infiltrating the German culture more than anybody, because he said they're not German, the Jews, and they're not Christian, the Jews. But people after a time can't see them, and that makes them dangerous. And that's Wagner.
Well, I think that's been a dangerous problem for a long time. The Jews claiming to be Christians. And time and time again, it's caused problems. I mean, that's what the Spanish Inquisition was about, wasn't it? These conversos that were calling themselves Christians, and then were still practicing the Talmud and introducing that. And I think that's where a lot of our problems with translations of the Bible come from. They've gone asking the descendants of the rabbis, or the descendants of the Pharisees, rather, to help them with their translation of the Bible. The descendants of the people that killed Christ. Of course, they're not going to tell you the truth about helping you out with translating the Bible. They're going to want to see it translated in a way that promotes their interests.
Exactly.
They're going to want to cover it up and hide, you know, what they did. I think it's a serious problem that it's one of the things that I disagree with E. Michael Jones about, and Michael Hoffman. They're both Catholic, and they both think that Jews can become converted to Christians, and then they're okay. But it's not, because time and time again through history, that's just caused nothing but problems.
Problems for us, yeah.
Still does today.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, those names, if you actually look at the names that they have, it's like Mountain of Gold, Flowers of Gold, Mountain of Silver, you know, Goldberg and Silverberg, Goldblum. It really
some
shows
them all together, though. That's a problem.
Shows their mentality.
Then you can recognise. But when they changed it to Smith and Jones, or in Ireland, you know, they'll give themselves an Irish name, makes it more difficult.
I don't think there weren't that many actually in Ireland. We get St. Patrick drove all the snakes out of Ireland. I think.
No, I mean, lately, with the, I mean, after World War II, I think there's a bit of an influx there.
I think that Shatter is Jewish, isn't he? The one that promotes immigration over there.
No doubt about that one.
Wherever they are, they do behave the same way. They promote the interests of themselves at the expense of the interests of the host nation. And it was the same thing in this Weimar period. Because they were internationalists, because they could hop from one country to another without any loyalty to any of the countries that they were in, they could see what was happening in Germany, and they would flock there with the money that they'd earned in places like America or in London, the people that have won the war. So those countries had lots of money. They would get the money from there, and then they would pour into Germany, where you had the starving German with backside hanging out the back of his trousers, where he couldn't afford to pay for his clothes, and then they would buy all the real estate from them and leave the Germans starving. I mean, there's pictures of them, isn't there, walking around with wheelbarrows, with all the money in a wheelbarrow, because they've got so much just in size of the actual money that they've got. It's as bad as it is today in Zimbabwe. It's rampant inflation, all caused by the Jews. So it's no wonder that something had to be done about it. And it's amazing how humane Hitler really was with them.
I agree. I totally agree. I mean, he's been vilified for something which, when you look into it, it wasn't the Germans. It was the Jews and the Allies what had committed. But then again, that's Marxism for you.
Well, this Weimar period, that's what they were promoting, wasn't it? We also had this little communist experiment, didn't we? Was that in Bavaria, where the communists actually took over?
Yeah, I think it was Bavaria for about 2 weeks they took over the government, but they were luckily they were sorted out.
Well, and one of the things they did was legalise sex with at any age, so that they were pushing to get all this perversity legalised, and eventually it was semi-legalised. In this Weimar period, where you had the people selling themselves, the children selling themselves, and all these perversities that you listed, Dennis. That's what the communists of the time wanted to promote and legalize and teach in schools. They saw that incest was fine. And then they realized that if they did push this, that it would destroy the country, destroy the nation. So Stalin actually put a stop to it. And that's why they realized this cultural Marxism, pushing all of that, was a weapon. So they didn't actually use it on themselves. And this is why the Eastern European countries haven't fallen to cultural Marxism like we have. Communists didn't do it to themselves. They knew that it was a weapon, which is the way that it's used today. It's used as a weapon against the white nations. It's all couched in lovey-dovey language and let the individual do what he likes with the other individual. But what it's really about is damaging society and destroying society, which makes it easier for the Jew to survive in that society. It makes it that he can earn more money, suck more blood from the country itself.
Yeah, well, it always amuses me when they call the nationalists extremists, because like I said, in Munich, you know, that was the base for the nationalist Germans, and then to call them extremists when they come into Berlin to try and, you know, humanize the place, then it's very strange to me that, you know, the extremism is the Marxist culture to me.
Well, we're called extremists today for saying that we disagree with homosexuality and sodomy and lowering of the age of consent and paedophilia. We're called extremists for that.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and I think paedophilia is the last bastion, really. I think that's the toughest one that they're going to find to pull off. Because if anything, disgusts the Western civilization, it is paedophilia. You know, homosexuality and lesbianism, they can get away with to an extent, you know what I mean? But paedophilia is the last bastion, which is probably why that's one of the last ones that they're going to try and bring in, because they may succeed, who knows, but that will cause eruptions, I think, in Western civilization.
Well, they're already trying to push it as just being a sexual orientation. Now, I think you can see with that Weimar period and the sort of prostitution that was available, pregnancy, animals, mothers, daughters, that as soon as you lose that respect for sex within marriage, and as soon as you allow sex outside of marriage, as soon as it stops being about producing a child and producing a family, then it gradually increases and gets worse and worse and worse and worse as people seek more extreme forms of pleasure, until it ends up with everything being legalized and there's no real love left anywhere. It's all just all about pleasure, all about pleasuring oneself.
I agree. It's like a drug, really, because, you know, a drug, you'll get a certain high, but then you've got to take more of that drug to get that high. And so it's the same with pornography and everything else. It's, you know, once that thrill's been achieved, you're looking to increase that thrill. And in the case of pornography and what went on in Berlin in them days, you know, you've got to seek for more perversions to get that thrill. And it's just a downhill slope. And which brings me back to when I used to say that these civilizations which lost God, which obviously Berlin would have done, usually end up a lost civilization.
Well, I think the problem with today is they're looking to the Jews to define who God is, and the Jews will try and say that by having sex, it doesn't matter who it's with, if you have as much sex as possible, and then you can find God in that. I mean, I've even heard that from some people. Even people in the church. I mean, you've got this homosexual vicar in the Church of England that says that he found God whilst being a bugger boy, basically the one that was the musician in Erasure, and they put him on Radio 4 all the time. He found God while he was being buggered. This is the level that we've reduced to. Anyway, we're getting a little bit down in the gutter at the moment, and we're actually nearing the end of the podcast. We want to try and finish on a happy tone.
Let's all remember it didn't take, like you said, it didn't take Goebbels and Hitler long to turn things around and make the streets safe to walk again.
It certainly didn't, and people can learn all about that in your documentary, can't they, Dennis? Do you want to let people know where they can find it?
Yep, I offer it at the Great Story Never Told .tv, Communism by the Backdoor .tv. Visit me on YouTube, Dennis Wise, and Facebook.
Okay.
Fun and Games.
Thank you very much for coming on, Dennis, and a Merry Christmas to you. And thank you very much for coming on, Messerschmitt, and a Merry Christmas to you. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week, same time, same place, for more Truth Without Radio. And a very happy Christmas to you.
Listeners, a happy Christmas and a diversity-free New Year.